You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, farms are getting bigger. That's come with some controversy about the impact on local communities. We'll talk about new research that says the impact of farm consolidation is more complicated than we might think. Now, our next guest says Wisconsin needs some democratic healing. Democratic with a small D, not the party. He says we used to have policies in place that encouraged public involvement in civic affairs and social programs designed to create a level playing field for the people of Wisconsin. Today, though, he says corporations and the very wealthy have too much political influence at the expense of the state's voters. He came out with a list of calls to action. Some of those ideas: ending partisan redistricting, putting into place ranked choice voting, tightening campaign finance laws, and rooting out structural racism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the state of elected government and democracy in Wisconsin? As a voter, do you feel like your voice is being heard, or do you feel like it's drowned out by a special interest, one or another, or the very wealthiest? Are there policies you'd like to see in place when it comes to things like redistricting or gerrymandering? And the list goes on. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Matt Rothschild is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and author of the new book, 12 Ways to Save Democracy in Wisconsin. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me back on. It's a real pleasure.
Before we get into some of your specific recommendations, how dire do you think that do you see things being? Does democracy need saving in Wisconsin?
Well, actually, it's pretty dire. In fact, it's more dire than it was when I finished writing the book almost a year ago. And it's more dire because of this onslaught again and assault on our democracy that we've seen from some Republicans in leadership in Wisconsin over the last 10 months. The Gableman investigation, fishing expedition, inquisition, whatever you want to call it. The denialism, the blatant sheer denialism that Joe Biden is actually our legitimate president. We see that from Janelle Branchen, who is a state assembly rep and head of the state assembly committee on elections. She sent an email in December telling her constituents that Trump actually won the election. You have Representative Ramphin, who has put a bill forward in the legislature to have Wisconsin withdraw its Electoral College votes, now almost a year after the Electoral College made its decision. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution to allow that. But this is just one bit of propaganda after another, one iteration of the big lie after another. And it's not only corrosive of our democracy, it's explosive of our democracy. And so that concerns me a lot, as does the anti-voter bills that were introduced, and as does the assault on our Wisconsin Elections Commission and our nonpartisan administration of our elections. So things are pretty dire.
Let's dive right into some of your recommendations. And one of them has been in the news a lot lately: how we draw our district lines, our political lines in Wisconsin. Why do you see this as important enough to be the first on your list?
Well, gerrymandering is a huge problem here in Wisconsin, and it gets to the problem of fair representation. We don't have fair representation in Wisconsin when the political party that's in power can rig the maps just by moving a line here or there on the district maps and not changing anybody's votes or anything, and ensure themselves a lock on power for 10 years. I mean, that's crazy. But that happened in 2011. In 2011, the Republicans had not just control of the state assembly and the state senate, but also control of the governorship. And they brought in a political scientist from Oklahoma, of all places, with some fancy software map drawing. And they were able to come up with a map that was ensuring themselves at least 60% of the seats in the assembly and the senate, essentially regardless of how the votes came down in one election after another. So that's pretty good gerrymandering if you can get away with it. And they got away with it. And even more disturbing, the Wisconsin Supreme Court just in the last month says it is going to use those rigged 2011 maps that a panel of federal judges said were unconstitutional. It's going to use those rigged 2011 maps as the basis for the new maps that it's going to sign off on in the next couple months. So we're going to be stuck with maps that were essentially rigged in 2011, that a panel of federal judges said were unconstitutional. In January 2016, this panel of federal judges said no one in Wisconsin should have to endure another election under such unconstitutional maps. And it looks like right now that we're going to be enduring these unconstitutional maps for another 10 years.
In your chapter on redistricting, you lay some blame on Democrats who, with the party control leading up to 2010, had the opportunity to change things. A bill was introduced to change things. They didn't do it. You're hoping this could fix things to prevent either side from taking advantage of a system like redistricting.
Yeah, Rob, I mean, this was a very disappointing story to learn. And I learned it because in 2009, let's remember, Democrats, it may be hard to believe, but Democrats controlled the state assembly, controlled the state Senate, and there was a Democrat in the governor's chair, Jim Doyle. And in 2009, there was a bill introduced by some progressive Democrats, Spencer Black among them, and there actually was a hearing on it to ban gerrymandering in Wisconsin and give us independent, nonpartisan redistricting like they've had in Iowa for 40 years. And it works great over there. It could work great here. But the leaders of the Democratic Party back in 2009 never brought it to a floor vote. Why didn't they bring it to a floor vote? Because political power is the most intoxicating drug on the market. And Democratic leaders thought, well, we got the power now. We'll have the power in 2010. We'll win again, and then we can rig the maps for ourselves. But lo and behold, look what that drunken political power did to them. It confused them terribly about who was going to win the 2010 elections. And let's remember who did win those elections. Scott Walker won the governorship, and Republicans swept the Democrats out of the state assembly and swept the Democrats out of the state Senate. And as soon as they had the power, the Republicans rigged the maps. Now, there still is a bill in the legislature right now that would ban gerrymandering in Wisconsin and give us essentially the Iowa model. But we can't even get that bill to a public hearing because Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux, the Republican leaders in the legislature, don't want that to happen. And so the public is overwhelmingly in favor of this, we don't get even a public hearing on it. I say the public's overwhelmingly in favor of it because there have been a couple polls from Marquette Law School showing two-thirds or more of the people in Wisconsin, including Republicans, want to ban gerrymandering in Wisconsin. And in 56 of our 72 counties, Rob, the people have voted either at county board resolutions or at countywide referendums by overwhelming margins that they want to ban gerrymandering. And this is just an example of how our democracy doesn't work. I mean, when, you know, two-thirds to three-quarters of the people of Wisconsin have said over and over they want something to happen and it doesn't happen, there's a problem.
Talking to Matt Rothschild about his new book, 12 Ways to Save Democracy in Wisconsin. Want to check out some of the other items on your list, Matt. Recusals for judges who have run for office and received campaign donations. Why do you see this as a problem? What's your solution?
Well, this is a real problem. And it came to the fore in the John Doe 2 investigation of Scott Walker for allegedly violating campaign finance law when he was coordinating with outside groups like Wisconsin Club for Growth and raising money through that group. And then that group was giving that money to Republicans in Wisconsin. There was a statute on the books at the time that said you can't do that. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court gave Scott Walker a get out of jail free card with a novel interpretation of the First Amendment. And a couple of the justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court were asked by the John Doe 2 prosecutor to recuse themselves from that case. But that means they have a conflict of interest. They should get off the case because of their conflict. What was their conflict of interest? Well, they had received more than or benefited from the expenditure of more than $1 million by two of the groups the John Doe 2 prosecutor was investigating, Wisconsin Club for Growth and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. But rather than recuse themselves, the two justices stayed on the case and actually dismissed the John Doe 2 investigation and fired the John Doe 2 prosecutor. So that was a corrupt move. And also the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been asked by the League of Women Voters and asked by 54 retired judges, including a couple former Wisconsin Supreme Court justices, to tighten up their recusal rules, have a tight definition of when a judge or a justice should get off a case because there's a conflict of interest. They didn't accept the petition by the League of Women Voters or the petition by the 54 retired judges and justices. Instead, they took a verbatim rule written by lawyers for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Wisconsin Realtors Association that said, it's just up to you guys. Essentially, there's no rule. It's up to the judge or the justice whether to get off a case or not if he or she thinks that he or she has a conflict. That's not a rule at all, really. And there's one other level of corruption in the judiciary right now. If I am a lawyer, I'm representing a client in circuit court, I can give the judge the judge's campaign $2,000, and neither that judge nor I needs to tell the lawyer on the other side of the case in front of the judge right now pending that I gave the judge $2,000. I mean, this is legalized bribery, and there's no transparency on the bribery either. So that's really corrupt. The solution is to pass a law to tighten judicial recusal rules. Representative Gary Hebel of Sun Prairie has been pushing this in one session after another, and we need to get it done. I think if your listeners understood just how open the invitation is for judicial corruption in Wisconsin, they'd be appalled.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Therese is with us in Green Bay. Therese, hi.
Hello. There's so many terrible things happening, including this last one and the others that your guest talked about. The issue is the people in power don't want to change things, and they build systems to allow things to favor them. And it's gotten so bad. There's a sense of hopelessness amongst those of us who want to change these things. And it's gotten so bad and egregious that our institutions weren't set up to handle this kind of battering. Yeah, the law he just talked about sounds good. But when you have a majority in the Assembly and Senate that aren't going to go for it, then you're stuck. And then you have an electorate on that particular end of things that's been told a lot of untruths about, the national election, et cetera, et cetera. We are at a crisis point where, I believe, what do we do? Those are good suggestions, but the people in power don't want to enact them. And finally,
Therese, I gotcha. Matt, we've got a break coming up, but Matt, that sense of hopelessness Therese has, I assume that's not the takeaway you want for your book.
No, I share Therese's anguish and her realization that is accurate, that we're at a crisis point for our democracy here in Wisconsin and nationwide for that matter. But I don't share her hopelessness. I'm happy to talk about that more after the break if you'd like. But there's a lot of great activism happening all across the state, which makes me less feeling hopeless.
Thanks for that call, Therese. We're talking to Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, about his new book, 12 Ways to Save Democracy in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like voters, everyday people, have enough power in Wisconsin? Or do you feel like the wealthy, the corporations are running the show? Are there changes you'd like to see made in our political system, our judicial system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking to Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. His new book is 12 Ways to Save Democracy in Wisconsin. Among the 12, ending partisan redistricting, reforming campaign finance, tightening judicial recusal rules, rooting out racism. You can join in with your thoughts on those topics and wider concerns you might have about our elected government in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt, we'd heard from Therese a few moments ago. A couple other callers have called in with similar concerns, feeling like there's not much they can do. If people agree with you on some or all of these solutions, what do you suggest they do to get involved?
Well, people should join pro-democracy organizations. One of the great things about being in Wisconsin is there's so many tremendous progressive nonprofits in this state, pro-democracy nonprofits. League of Women Voters of Wisconsin is a tremendous group. So is Common Cause, Wisconsin Conservation Voters, Bloc, Voces de la Frontera, They're just tremendous groups all across the board. Find the issue that concerns you the most. Join an organization that works on that issue. Join it with a friend of yours, because it's easier if you do this work with friends in organizations. Because if we do it in isolation, it's too big of a mountain to climb, and we'll get discouraged and we'll give up. And that's not good for us. That's not good for the pro-democracy movement. I mean, let's face it, though. We are facing a militant, aggressive anti-democracy movement in this state and in this country, the likes of which we haven't seen since 20,000 pro-Nazis gathered in Madison Square Garden under Nazi flags back in 1939. And what we need to do is lift up the voices of courageous Republicans who are speaking truth about this threat. And I'm talking about Liz Cheney. Thank you, Liz Cheney. And Adam Kinzinger. Thank you, Adam Kinzinger. And here in Wisconsin, State Senator Kathy Bernier, who is chair of the Senate Elections Committee, has done a very brave thing, and she should be praised to the heavens for it, because she is calling this out as a charade. And she has expressed her deep concern that we may be losing our republic right now to the right wingers. That was very brave of her. Second, we need to create a united front against this anti-democracy movement and rally everybody on our side to face it together. And then, and I think this is really important, Rob, we need to engage a few folks in our wide social circles here in Wisconsin who may have been tempted by some of the cultish propaganda. And we need to try to listen to them first, connect with them in some non-political way, engage in conversation with them, and then try to nudge them back from the abyss. You know, every other person in Wisconsin who voted last time voted for Trump, and a large percentage of the Republican Party still believes that Trump is the legitimate president or the election was stolen from him. But a chunk of those folks don't believe that, and they need to be engaged in conversation with, and even some who may actually believe it. If we can try to peel off a few of those people and bring them back to reality, even though they're being fed this propaganda on an IV drip 24/7 from Fox News and social media, I think that is a real service we need to do. We can't write off half the people in the state of Wisconsin.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Don is with us in Door County. Don, hello.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you, Matt, for all the hard work you do. I have insight into Representative Joel Kitchens and Senator Cole's support for Senate Bill 250, which is ranked choice voting, but only for Wisconsin federal elections. I have audio, and when I called into the local radio station on Tuesday, and Representative Kitchens said they're looking for a way to diffuse partisan support in some of the more heavily partisan districts in the state. So I think their support of ranked choice voting, which they said should be implemented, I suggested they do it for the whole state, for all our elections. But anyway, so there's a little insight for two Wisconsin representatives supporting Senate Bill 250 for partial ranked choice voting in the state of Wisconsin. Thank you. I'll listen in.
Don, thanks for the call. Matt, ranked choice voting is one of your recommendations. Why?
Yeah, I'm in favor of it, primarily because it would get rid of the spoiler effect. I mean, ranked choice voting is when, rather than just voting for one person, you rank the candidates in favor of your first choice, second choice, and third choice. So, for instance, in the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000, you could have voted for Ralph Nader number one and Al Gore number two. And then when it turned out that Ralph Nader came in, didn't come in close on ranked choice voting, when your first choice is coming in last or near last, your vote, your first place vote gets canceled, and then your second place vote becomes your first place vote. So those Nader votes would have then gone to Gore, and Gore would have been president of the United States. And it would be neat in like crowded Democratic fields, like remember the last primary when Governor Evers was running with 10 other candidates, including Mayor Paul Soglin and some other good candidates. I mean, you could add ranked choice voting there. You could have said, I want Soglin number one, and I want Evers number two, or Mike McCabe number three. And then the candidate who wasn't doing the best, if that was your number one, then you'd get some choice, some say into who the actual winner is. So I think it is a good way to end the spoiler effect. And it also may diffuse some of the hyper partisanship that comes out of the two-party system. And that wouldn't be a bad thing either.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. One of the things I've been telling my kids for about 10 years now is the most difficulty they're going to have in their future is determining fact from fiction. That we have the capability with the technology to fake any video. We could have put Trump on his face on one of the January 6th attackers, and it would have looked so real that it would have circulated around the world in within an hour, and people would have thought Trump was right there. So I think
we have just a few moments left, and Matt, that reminds me, local journalism as part of the effort to sift and winnow fact from fiction. That is one of your concerns.
Yes, it is. And I think Mike makes a good point because people are living in two different media universes. You know, right wingers can just be in their own media ecosystem. Left wingers can be in their own. And that's not healthier for democracy either. I think people need to read around and get outside of their media cocoons. But I also think we really need to support local media here in Wisconsin. There are many towns and cities and even counties that are newspaper deserts that don't have any local newspaper anymore. So it's really hard for the citizens of those towns, cities, and counties to know what's happening locally and also to get a set of facts, local facts, that they can use to examine what they're being fed on the internet or on TV and see whether the two things collide or not. And maybe if they got a better sense of the news locally, they'd be better able to distinguish fact from fiction. And that's a crucial thing we've got to be able to do.
Thanks for that call. And Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Rob, my pleasure. Happy holidays.
To you too. That's Matt Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We talked to him about his new book. It's called 12 Ways to Save Democracy in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some nutrition talk. Do we eat more protein than we actually really need to? Check out the results of some new studies, new research on nutrition and protein in our diets. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, we talked to the author of a new book about the science of smell, including a couple tries by theaters over the years to have some kind of smell device to go along with movies. It didn't catch on, so how about this? Instead of theaters with smell-o-vision, how about TVs with a tasting function? As reported by Reuters, a professor in Japan who works on food-related technology built a prototype for a tastable TV called the Taste the TV. It uses a carousel of flavor canisters that spray flavor combos onto a rolling film on the TV surface that viewers can lick. The inventor has some specialized ideas for how it could be used, say distance learning cooking classes, could be used for home food tastings and quizzes too. Would I use it? If it's a personal TV, I guess it's not so bad. They start installing them at airport terminals? Pass. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what kind of farm would you want in your community? Small dairy farm owned by someone you know, or a big 500-head dairy farm run by someone you've never met who might not even live in your community? If your answer was the small farm, you're not alone. For years, people have pointed to the trend of farms getting bigger as a problem, with some researchers arguing that big corporate farms are bad for rural communities. But our next guest says it's actually more complicated than that. He's the co-author of new research looking at the impact of farm consolidation on community well-being. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is it hard for small family farms to operate in your community? Have you seen them getting bigger and bigger where you live? If you are a farmer yourself, Do you have a small operation, maybe what they call a hobby farm or boutique sort of operation, or have you gotten bigger, or have you left the field? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Deller is regional economist at the UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good. Well, before we get into the study itself, Steve, the origins of it, it's kind of interesting. This started as an undergraduate student project?
Yes, it did. The economics department, the undergraduate student club, actually tries to hook up with faculty or researchers across campus to try to get a little bit of exposure, to have the students kind of exposed to, you know, what's it like to actually do a research project. And Iris Parks and I kind of hooked up on this question, and next thing you know, we ended up with a pretty good study.
Now let's get into farm consolidation. First of all, what do we see when it comes to the size of farms in Wisconsin and how that's changed over the years?
What's really happened is that when you look at the size of farms, much of the consolidation that was occurring kind of occurred in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and then it kind of plateaued. So a lot of the consolidation that we're seeing now is kind of small compared to what was going on back in the 60s and the 70s. So what we're seeing now really is not so much that the average size farm is getting bigger. Indeed, it's not. It's kind of for the last 30 years almost, the average size farm has basically stayed the same. What's happened is the distribution around that average size farm. We're seeing kind of a hollowing out, if you will, of the middle of that distribution. If you think of it kind of like a bell-shaped curve, right, where the average farm is kind of in the middle there, what's happening is that middle is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. There's fewer people in that middle. What's happening is we're seeing growth at the what's called the two tails. The bigger farms, right, we're seeing some growth in the bigger farms, but we're seeing much more growth in the smaller farms. And that's where this kind of, you know, it's more complicated than simply farms getting bigger. We're seeing growth in small farms.
Now, part of what you're looking into here is what does it mean in a community if you lose those mid-sized farms and you only have the really big one that's maybe, you know, the owner and a bunch of hands, but not, I guess, owner-occupied farms all over the place and these tiny ones. First of all, how do you even start to try to answer a question like that? What does it mean for community well-being?
How do you define community well-being? If you look at kind of like economic growth, the relationship between farming and economic growth has gotten weaker and weaker and weaker over time. It's because so much of the rural economy has kind of grown beyond farming. Farming has stayed basically the same size. It's gotten a little bit bigger, but the rest of the economy has gotten bigger, particularly in Wisconsin. Now, if you're talking about the Corn Belt, say Iowa, then, you know, things could be a little bit differently. But the relationship between farming and the community is really kind of, it's changed. If you're looking at the large farms, the real impact of the large farms on the local community is through the wages that are paid. Particularly for dairy, it's the hired help spending their money in the local economy. That's where a lot of the economic impact is coming in. The other is kind of feeding into the food processing. In Wisconsin, food processing is extremely important. But what's happening at the other end is that we're seeing this growth in kind of, you think about it, the local foods movement, kind of this niche agriculture, if you will, or these specialty crops, if you will. There's real growth in that end. Those farms tend to be much, much smaller. So you have this kind of that typical average size farm doesn't really exist anymore. They're either smaller, specialized, or they're really big. Now, what's really kind of turned the relationship around between the farming and community is that for years and years and years, we used to think that rural communities depended upon farming. That relationship has really changed. Increasingly, all but the biggest farms, the farm household, the farm family, the vast majority of their income comes from off-farm sources. So it's not so much the farm contributing to the local economy. It is, but not that much. It's more that ability to generate off-farm income to keep the farm going. So that relationship has really kind of changed, but for the smaller size farms. For the bigger farms, they're still, you know, they may have off-farm income for primarily something like, say, health insurance. But the relationship between the big farms and the local community is still kind of that direction, but through the labor component.
Talking to Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, looking at changes in the scale of farming lots, as we're hearing, of smaller farms, a trend toward much, much larger, more consolidated farms, hollowing out the middle. What does it mean for rural communities? You could join in maybe with your experience in your community on your own farm at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Steve, let's take that case and look at your research here. You've got a community. It used to have a bunch of those mid-sized farms. They're not there anymore. Most of them are gone. And they've been replaced by maybe one or two or three operations of these larger scale farms. As you tapped into these measures of well-being, what kind of changes did you see, for better, worse, or neither?
Well, it depends on how you measure it. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do when we talked about community well-being is that we looked at things like economic well-being, poverty, business startup rates, income levels. We also looked at things like public health and a wide range of kind of metrics. Well, it depends on how you define community well-being. Business startups, for example, having more farms, you actually see more business startups. That's one indicator. But in terms of health, you kind of have running a farm can be a very stressful thing. So it depends. It depends. And that's why one of the things with this whole kind of literature is trying to better understand the relationship between farming and community well-being is that we can't nail it down. We can't get a definitive answer. And the reason is because agriculture keeps changing. There's a big difference between a corn and soybean farmer that has 5,000 acres in central Illinois compared to a smaller farm, say in the Driftless area, that is trying to go into the local foods market. They're apples and oranges. And trying to draw a definitive generalization becomes very, very difficult.
But what things stood out to you in that consolidation scenario I just laid out? It's bigger farms. Were there that changes that struck you in terms of local economies, those local measures of well-being?
The bigger the farm, it really boils down to how profitable is that farm and how well can it pay the farmer and the workers. The bigger the farms, they tend to be able to afford to pay better wages. Those better wages have a positive impact on the local economy. So if you have a choice between 10 farms that are operating at poverty levels or two big farms that are actually paying halfway decent wages, you're better off with the two bigger farms because of the income that's going to the people that are working the farm. Now, when you're looking at a corn and soybean operation, though, you're not hiring that many workers. If you're talking about a dairy operation, you're talking about a lot of workers. So, again, it depends on what kind of process you're looking at.
We're talking to Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about the effect of farm consolidation on rural communities. Lots of variables there, as we're hearing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen farming change in your community, in your part of the state? If you're a farmer yourself, what has changed for you? What kind of farming do you do? Have you gotten bigger in your operation, hiring more people? Have you gotten smaller and more specialized? If you live in a community that depends a lot on farming for the local economy, how have these things shaken out for you? And would you rather have a smaller farm, say dairy farm, as your neighbor versus a much larger one? Why would you go one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the impact of farm consolidation on rural communities. Steve Deller with UW-Madison stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think bigger is better when it comes to farming, or do you want to see lots of smaller operations? What has changed when it comes to agriculture, to the farm sizes and operations in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Roger is with us in Cottage Grove. Roger, hi.
Hi. I haven't heard Steve Deller talk about one of the really important measures of well-being, and that is the environment, how large farms affect the water quality, both surface and groundwater quality, and the air quality in rural communities. That's just a really, really important consideration in terms of a measure of well-being. And haven't heard any discussion about that. Would like to hear him comment on that.
Roger, thanks a lot for the call. And this is a big concern when people are worried about, especially larger livestock operations. Steve, I'm not sure if this current research went into that, but do you have some thoughts for Roger?
That's actually an excellent question. And our ability to kind of do these analyses, we're now able to actually start to talk about environmental impacts. We had kind of a, you know, dreamt about doing it 10 years ago, but now the science has advanced and we can actually start doing it. So, Roger, I hope to have some specific answers for you maybe by summertime. But you have, there's two things with farming. One is that many farmers are really very pro-environmental because they're kind of, they have this connection to the land that is very unique. So the vast majority of farmers are actually very sensitive to sustainable practices and not, being a poor steward of the land. The problem, though, is that you'll have one or two that are sloppy and you can actually have a fair amount of damage. You hear about perhaps a manure pit, a dairy manure pit that springs a leak and there's a massive fish kill off. So we tend to see things like that, but I think the vast majority of farmers are actually pretty sensitive and really want to try to do the right thing when it comes to the environment. But look around summertime. I hope to have a better answer than that for you.
Roger, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Jim now in Waniwak. Jim, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm a retired farmer, and as I told your screener, between my farm and the closest town is 5 miles, and years ago there were 12 farms there milking cows, and now there's one, and he uses robotic milkers. So big change in the landscape, big change in the tax base because of all the farm buildings and houses that are gone, school districts that don't have the kids that they used to, small town businesses that don't have the local base of support that they used to. And I think it all comes down to price, that farms went out because they weren't paid a good enough price. And once we lost the parity programs of the New Deal and the consolidation took over, that changed everything.
Jim, thank you so much for sharing your story. Steve, your thoughts?
You're right. I mean, there are, as I mentioned before, there's this notion of get bigger, get out, and that's not true. There are some farmers that decide that maybe getting bigger is right for them, and they make that decision, good for them. There are others that say, you know, we can't maintain it the way it is. What we're going to do is we're going to downsize. We're going to get a little bit smaller. We're going to go to, say, grazing, or we'll go to specialty crops or something like that, but we need that off-farm income. We need somebody working off the farm to bring money into the farm family. And we're seeing a tremendous growth in that kind of a market. So the relationship between the community and the farm has kind of been turned on its head a little bit. Now, farmers that are able to get that off-farm income, or a spouse or someone in the family get that off-farm income, that can help keep that farm alive. If there is no off-farm employment opportunities, then you're right. There's not much left for them to do, and they decide they're going to shut the farm down. They may rent the land, or it may turn into recreational use. But you're right. It's we're going through some structural changes now.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Cindy in Spring Green. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I'd like to just reiterate what everybody else has said. I know that you said they pay higher wages, the larger farms, but there's also the wear and tear that that huge machinery has on our roads, and they don't pay a road tax to help defer those costs. And so I wonder what the trade-off is in high wages versus environmental versus the road wear and tear. Thank you.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Steve, with that road wear and tear, Roger earlier talked about environmental impact, worries about what I think you economist types call externalities, things that come as costs to the area that the producer doesn't directly pay for. How big a concern do you see that?
That is with the bigger farms that is becoming a problem. And the reason is because these bigger farms tend to go to larger equipment. The equipment is much heavier, and a lot of the roads are not built to handle that kind of weight. Not so much the roads, it's the bridges and the culverts. They tend to collapse. I mean, many of these culverts and whatnot were built, 50 years ago and were not designed to handle those kind of heavy equipment. So you do end up with situations where farmers, it's not uncommon to hear a farmer say, look, I've got two fields that are adjacent to each other, but I got to go over a bridge or a culvert to get from one to the other, and I can't, which means I've got to go a mile around to get to the other field. Those are becoming more common because we're moving towards bigger and bigger equipment. So the ability to invest in kind of that basic infrastructure is going to become more important.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison, looking at the economics of farming, and it's changed a lot here in the state. Steve, a cultural issue. You mentioned this in your report. There's the idea associated going back to Thomas Jefferson and others of the independent farmer who their whole livelihood is the farm. It's big enough they can live off of it. It's not so big that they're an aristocrat of some sort. The farms you're talking about, the big, large-scale farms and these small hobby farms or, farms where people need outside income, neither of them fit that sort of tradition, that cultural idea in the United States. Does this mean something?
Yeah, it is. And I think that that's a lot with what people are struggling with, is that those types of farms, the Jeffersonian notion of of that kind of farm, the economics just doesn't work anymore. And the economics has been turning against that kind of farm for over 70 years. And that's why we're seeing this kind of shift that if you want to maintain and continue to have some kind of farm enterprise and getting big is just not right for you, then we have to look at other sources of employment. And that's where this relationship gets flipped. And, proximity, if you happen to have a smaller farm and you happen to be within a reasonable commuting distance to, say, Eau Claire or La Crosse, or even a Green Bay, where there are employment opportunities, you have a much better opportunity to keep the farm up and running than, say, if you don't have those employment opportunities. And it is, and I think that's partially what a lot of folks are really struggling with, is this idealized American farmer is changing.
We've been talking about the farms themselves. Have you seen similar consolidation trends when it comes to the suppliers of farm equipment, say seed, pesticides, and more on the one side, and the people who buy farmers' produce and turn it into the food we eat?
Yeah, there's been tremendous. I mean, in Wisconsin, when you look at the contribution of agriculture to the Wisconsin economy, it's the processing side. And there's been a lot of consolidation in that. But what we're seeing here is consumers are looking at their food options as kind of one of two kinds. One is kind of what we call commodity food products. This would be cheese that goes on a frozen pizza, right? It's just a pizza and it's a frozen pizza. You're not willing to pay a whole lot for it, right? The other are arsenial foods, artisan foods, if you will, local foods, if you will, organic foods, foods that people are willing to pay a little bit more. And that's where we're seeing that break apart. If you're producing for that commodity market, you've got to kind of get big. I mean, that's the way the economics works. But with this growth in the interest of artisan cheeses, of artisan, well, artisan apples, I'm not sure you can, you know, but locally grown, locally sourced, that's a market that has allowed a lot of the farmers to kind of say, hey, I can shift over into that market, and I can still keep the farm running. But I need to have something off-farm to keep the family afloat. There's one story of an organic farmer that said, you know, I love what I do. I love what I do, but I got three kids I got to put through college. And those are the kind of decisions that they're looking at. So it's kind of a consumer tastes have changed, and that's created opportunities for a lot of farmers.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about new research on farm consolidation and its impact. He worked on it with Iris Sujin Park, now a graduate student in the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with some creative ideas for holiday baking, maybe something that'll put your last-minute project over the top. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.